For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so here it is. Let's just dive into the passage. This is chapter 16, verse 1, and it says Sarai, she hasn't been called Sarah yet, Abram's wife, and he hasn't been called Abraham yet. They had born no children, and she had an Egyptian maid named Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Since the Lord has prevented me from bearing children, please go sleep with my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." So Abram agreed with this plan. And so here we have the beginning of the Ishmael narrative. And the background is important here because it hinges on a problem, and it's a problem that we have seen repeatedly. In verse 1, it just simply says, Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne no children. And if you've been studying along or reading with us on this, you realize that this hairlessness problem is significant because God has said, I'm going to make from you, Abraham, or Abram, in Genesis 12, a great nation. And so for that reason, then God, Abram and his family, they left Haran, they went into the land of Canaan. They've been really roaming around for now into the decades, and still no heir, no son to begin to build this great nation. And so five times in the story up to this point, in fact, our narrator has reminded us, hey, Sarai had no son, no heir. And so here we see in chapter 16 a kind of a decisive action on their part to deal with this problem. And so like last week when we were studying Genesis 15, it was the same thing. Abraham goes before God and says, since I have no heir, Eliezer of Damascus, who is not even my son, he will be my heir. And God says, no, it's not going to go down that way. And so God keeps just ongoing way, reassuring them, hey, I'm going to fulfill my promise. Don't worry about it. They're worrying every step of the way. These guys are worrying. They're getting older and older and older. Now Sarai is somewhere in her mid to late 70s. And she makes this point, and here I think marks a bit of a change of perspective. She says, we're going to have to do what we're going to have to do because the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. So now where is she putting the onus of responsibility here? It's something that God, he's delaying this thing. He's preventing this from happening. And there's pretty much less a minor or subtle criticism of God involved with this. What is she really saying about God? We're ready to do God's bidding. We want to do God's plan. We're ready for this nation, but God's just not cooperating. And so this is a real problem when it comes to her whole understanding of God. We're going to come back to this point toward the end of our discussion tonight because it's a very important one, that this childlessness problem that Sarah was having really was having a profound and corrosive effect on her own faith. This dilemma of what God says is going to happen and the experience contrary really runs throughout this narrative. And it really comes into this one in a big way. Well, there's a solution, which is, okay, Abram, here's Hagar. She's my servant. Just have a child through her, and it'll be my child. And that's kind of the good old-fashioned God helps those who help themselves philosophy. That's not in the Bible, by the way. Contrary to what many people have thought, actually, this is actually from Benjamin Franklin, Poor Richard's Almanac. And that's where the expression God helps those who help themselves come from. And it's just basically the idea that, you know, you got to get it on, get engaged, do the thing, because you really can't rely on God to do it for you. And so that's exactly what they're doing. And it really marks what I think we could just call here an act of regression. And by that, what I mean is that God had consistently promised, you're going to have an heir. And the last chapter, in chapter 15, he was so explicit. It's from your own body that this heir will come, he says to Abram. And And now they're doing something that's really pretty different. You'll notice there's nothing in the passage in chapter 16 like there was in chapter 15 where Abraham is pouring his heart out before God. He's really seeking God. There's a moment of crisis for him that God responds to in chapter 15 when he says, this man, Eliezer of Damascus, he's not going to be the heir. I'm going to raise up a child from your own body. In this case, it lacks that attentiveness to prayer and really seeking God out. They're just going to go it on their own. And what they are doing is essentially caving to the conventions of their culture. In the ancient Near Eastern world, and we know this from the famed Code of Hammurabi, which was written just a couple hundred years after this event from Babylon, from the Nuzi civilization, which is where in Haran up in the north in modern-day Syria, and other ancient legal codes, we know that it was a common practice if a woman was unable to have children, that a servant in their household could be given to her husband. And if he bears a child through the servant, then it legally falls to the wife. It's really her child. And so in that sense, what Abraham and Sarah were doing was essentially just trying to find a solution to this problem that the culture had supplied to them. And so in that way, it kind of veers off of God's ideal for them. But it illustrates this point that there are cultural norms in our society, in every society, that will sometimes inform sub-biblical decision-making. And so that we rely on the outlook of our culture, the value systems of our culture, over what God in His Word has described as His will. And so we're going to have to come back to this point at the end too, because this is a super important point. We are not in any way aliens to the faith of Abram and Sarah. In a lot of ways, they're very much like us. And so let's press on. The results, it says in verse 4, Abram slept with Hagar and she conceived. And when Sarai saw that Hagar had conceived, she despised her. And Sarai treated Hagar harshly and she actually fled from Sarai's presence. And so you see the trajectory here. We're going to do it our way, which is our culture's way. We're not going to wait on God to do what God said He was going to do. We're going to figure it out in our own terms. And this is where it leaves us. It leaves us in this terrible place where on the one hand, Hagar has this pride that see, I can provide for Abram what you, his wife, can't. And there's a lot of, you know, just competitive arrogance here on her part that, see, I'm really more important than you are. And Sarai, of course, is humiliated by this and begins to treat her harshly, so much so that Hagar escapes, essentially, Abram's household. God has to actually chase her down to deal with this. But there's a cause and effect here, again, that we need to be aware of, which is that when we divert from God's design, when we go our way, which is not His way, even when our society says, of course you ought to go that way, it ends in a bad place, in a broken place, where relationships are sacrificed, where the worst of who we are as human beings burbles to the surface, such as it is here with this catfight between Sarai and Hagar. But God is still in the mix, and because God loves this child and the entire household of Abram, no matter who you are in that household, there is a blessing that God gives to this child, Ishmael. And so it says in chapter 17, verse 20, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, I will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly, and he shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. What an amazing passage this is. It's just full of incredible blessings. If you drill down just a little bit, you begin to see. And so he says, I heard you, which is essentially what Ishmael's name actually is in the Hebrew. God hears. And the cry of this woman who's been rejected from her household. He says of this son, I will bless him and he will be fruitful and multiply. That same creation blessing that God gave to Adam and Eve and then later in the generations of Noah and down to the present time, it's still God's intent to bless his people. And Ishmael is one of his people. He is a child, a son of Abraham. And from him, it says, will come 12 princes. And princesses too, probably. But anyway, the point here being that just as there will be, in just a couple of generations, 12 tribes for Abraham through Isaac and then through Jacob, so for Ishmael also there will be 12 princes. And so he's pronouncing blessing on him, that he will prosper, that there will be nations that emerge, Ishmaelites, and that those nations matter to God. And so that's the Ishmael cycle of the narrative. Now we want to move on to the Isaac narrative. It says in chapter 17, verse 16, God said to Abraham, now his name is Abraham, by the way, because earlier in chapter 17, God's like, no, Ishmael was a false start. That's not what I said. And then he renews the promise. Yes, I'm going to make from you a great nation. And then he says, let's mark this moment, so to speak, with this thing called circumcision. And so Abraham and his household were circumcised to make so as the sign of the covenant relationship. And his name was changed at that time then from Abram to Abraham. So God said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah, which means princess, shall be her name. I'll bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be the mother of nations. Kings will come forth from her. All right, so this is the beginning of the Isaac story. The problem, is it different than the Ishmael problem? No, it's exactly the same. There's still no heir. The promise has been issued numerous times now, but still no tangible evidence that there's fulfillment of that promise. And now the sands are moving through the hourglass, and Sarai and Abram are old. Significant problem, but a different solution this time. And so God renews the promise. From Sarah will come this great blessing of nationhood. Not even one nation, but kings in the plural will come forth from her. Indeed, and that's exactly what happened. So God is going to affect this thing. And look at the language here in verse 16. I will bless, I will give, I will bless. Repeatedly, it's being repeated for the reason that it underlies this basic principle that only God can fulfill the promises that he makes. Man, you need to underline that, circle that, emblazon that in your memory. Some of you love to get tattoos. Tattoo that. I will bless, I will give. Because that's the reality of it. Whatever God promises, whatever God promises, he and he alone will fulfill. That's the principle. That's the point. That's why in the story of Genesis, every generation of the patriarchs has exactly the same problem. Sarah is infertile, but then so is Isaac's wife, Rebecca, and Jacob's wife, Rachel. They all share the same problem, and they are all the ones upon whom is hinging the furtherance of God's promise to make a great nation. And it just underscores this point throughout the Genesis narrative at every step along the way. God promises, and there is nothing human beings can do to fulfill that promise. It is utterly up to God. He is the only one who can fulfill his promise. And that's why, and it's just underscored by this pattern. That's what a motif is. This pattern that the promise of God will come through means that only God himself can supply. So that's a significant point in how this narrative is laid out. It is a significant point of contrast between the Isaac story and the Ishmael story, because the Ishmael story is all about what can we go out there and do to fulfill God's promise, and the Isaac story is just exactly the opposite. You see how that works. Now, let's press on just a little bit further. Let's think about the response. Now God is really making it clear to Abraham and to Sarah, this child is coming down the pipe for you. And you can just imagine that word of clarity. That's not what I meant. I see you laughing. That's not exactly what I meant. You know how that is. No, you don't. Forget, I'm digging myself into a bigger pit. Let's move on. The response... You know, so here it is. The whole thing is laid out. So here's the obvious response. Hey, thanks, God. I just needed you to remind me. Right? That's what you would expect when the Lord God Almighty comes and says, hey, just so you know, next year at this time, I'm going to come back and... you will have this son that I've promised you. That's like, wow, thanks so much for that reminder, right? Or not. Verse 17, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. And he said in his heart, because he wasn't willing to say it to God, will a child be born to a man 100 years old and to Sarah who is 90? And then a similar conversation in chapter 18, verse 12, where Sarah laughed and said to herself, after I have become old, shall I have this pleasure, my Lord, being old also? No. Of course not. This is absurd. Come on, we know what manopause and menopause is all about. We know what an aging body means to pregnancy. We're not stupid. So when God comes along and says, this is the way it's going to be, you're like, that's so absurd, it's laughable. It's totally bizarre. Well, God interacts with that because he knows exactly what they're thinking. He knows what you're thinking too. And there's only one question that really matters now, and that's the question God asks. The Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I indeed bear a child in my old age? And then he says, is anything too difficult for the Lord? I will come to you this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. Is anything too difficult for the Lord? Okay, so here's the point. In the life of faith, there is this principle that God and God alone will fulfill his promises, what we've been talking about. Here's another point, and that's this, that this is always the question of faith. It is the question, is anything too difficult for the Lord? Think about your life. We're going to come back to this at the end, but think of your life right now. You're up against a lot of things. Many of us are up against very difficult things, things that are vexing, things that are painful. Things that we wonder, how can this possibly be reach some place of resolution in my life? Where's the peace? We wonder about these things, and God is responding, and he's asking this question, is anything? And by anything, he means anything. That means whatever it is in your life, he's saying, is anything too difficult for the Lord? Okay? Now, let's press on, because God indeed answers their request. God indeed blesses them. The child is born. And it says in verse 5 now of chapter 21, now Abram was 100 years old when Isaac was born, and Sarah said, God has made laughter for me. Isn't that awesome? The irony of that just cannot be lost on the reader. There was a year before laughter, but it was a laughter of cynicism, of unbelief. And now we have the laughter of joy and delight. And everyone, she says, who hears will laugh not at me, but with me. She said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse his children? That's just crazy. And so there you have then the contrast between Ishmael and Isaac. Two kinds of approaches to understanding God. And now the question that we need to ask here tonight is, what does it mean? What's the significance of this? And we want to draw conclusions along two lines. First, it's all about faith. This is an important picture of faith. No one is referred to in the New Testament more as a paradigm, a model of faith, than Abraham. And here is really a part of the unfolding drama of the faith that is Abraham's. And the first thing about this that we observe is that it's a work in progress. Okay? I live in Westerville, as we affectionately call it these days, because there are under construction things going on at all times. It is the most frustrating thing. I spent 40 minutes driving home from work from this place, 4 miles from here. 40 minutes. Why? Why, God? Because it just seems like the whole freaking town is under construction. It's so irritating. I was sitting there watching cycle after cycle after cycle of lights go from, you know, red to green and back to red and so forth. And it occurred to me, I wonder if God looks at my life and says, whoa, it's so frustrating. So annoying. That's the way faith always is. It's never perfect, never complete. You know, interesting, this story between Isaac and Ishmael, it's not even done yet. It doesn't end until later in chapter 21, the second to last chapter in the Bible about Abraham, where they are still bickering with each other, Sarah and Hagar, Ishmael and Isaac. And poor Abraham is just pulling whatever hair is left on his head out. It's not a perfect faith. If it's our thinking that God is waiting for perfect faith before he can be active in our lives, then we are not understanding God. Our faith will never be perfect. The question of our faith is not how strong is our faith or even how consistent is our faith, but what is the object of our faith? Even the smallest reliance upon the promise of God is sufficient for God to move his program forward in our life and through our lives to other people. Who's under construction? You're under construction. I'm under construction. Abraham's under construction. We are all in this world under construction. And it's sloppy and it's messy. It's the way our lives work. There is with us, just as there was with Abraham and Sarah, a real danger of regression, of trying to take matters into our own hands, of diverting from taking our stand with the promises of God, believing that what he promised, he will fulfill, and doing it our way, which is to say the way that the wisdom of the culture around us. And so the real challenge of faith really is in the backdrop and context of those things that erode the foundations of faith. Let's think about this. How aware are you of the things that enter into your decision-making process? Your life is, and where it goes, the trajectory of your life, the legacy of your life, really revolves around a number of very important decisions that you make. And for that reason, we're never more than a couple of bad decisions from really derailing the thing. That happens. But conversely, we're never more than a couple of really good decisions away from really putting it together as well. And so we are confronted by important decisions that affect every facet of our life. And the question is, How are we entering into that decision-making process? Let's think about this. How do you think about personal conflict? What do you see there? Do you see that as the necessity of your will triumphing over another's? Of making sure that they see things your way, that the resolution happens on your terms. That's what our culture teaches us. Be true to yourself, which means basically that my primary commitment is to self. And if I can't get the other person to come alongside and agree that I am, in fact, the center of my universe, why, then it's time to move on. And that relationship is broken. And that's why in our culture, the real great social tragedy that we face is not about race and gender and terrorism and all of these things. It is the broken heart of humanity that demands life on our own terms. And that's the wisdom of the world. And that's how we're trained to think. And my friends, that is a prescription for disaster. That's the Hagar-Sarah conclusion. And what is God calling us to is something very different. It's the power of grace, of humility, to enter into these conflicts that we're having in our marriages, among friends, in our home churches. Wherever we exist, there is the potential of conflict. Do you agree? Unless you're just so superficial that no one really knows what's going on in your life. But the reality is that when we get real, we get conflict because we are just that kind of people. But what will prevail here? And are we prepared to trust that if we are willing to humble ourselves and to move with forgiveness, that indeed these conflicts can be resolved in a way that a standoff of egos would never allow? That's very important. Do you feel? Do you sense? Does your blood pressure raise when you're beginning to realize you're in a disagreement with somebody? Mine does. And what's going through your mind? I don't care what they're saying. It's what I need to say that counts. Right? We shut it off. It's got to be my way. Tell me I'm not the only one who's like that. So we can have a triumph of grace, or we can have a failure of the flesh. How do you think about excellence and success? We had some conversations last week with some friends about this that was, I think, really important. One of our friends was telling us about, she's a very accomplished person, she's very smart. And highly educated, highly trained, and highly focused for that reason on accomplishment in her career, that's not a bad thing. But what she began to realize was, you know what, the reality is that I'm playing out a script that I just have ever since I was 3 feet high. I had. That was just, of course, the expectation that you go, you get yourself educated, you become somebody, you know, it's about you and being all you can be and this type of thing. And she's like, you know, the weird thing is I realize I've got very clear sense of fulfillment from accomplishment in this area, laser focus on what do I need to do to advance my career, and I'm very diligent to perform it. How come it is I don't have that same focus, diligence, and zeal for the things of God? I wonder about that for many of us. That, yeah, you know, our culture tells us, and this is the danger of regression among people like so many of us here who are in that upper middle class kind of place in life and in society where it really, you know, we are really playing out a script that our culture just emphasizes and puts out to us as this is what it looks like to be somebody and to be successful. And we're eager to jump on that train. But is that really the train? Again, not to say that careers are unimportant or anything like that. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. But the question is what's the engine that's driving the train here? What is the value system upon which we're making these important decisions? You know, so many people that I interact with are just, you know, super sharp and can tell you for hours about their area of expertise in business or computers or whatever it is. But then when we turn to the things of God, all of a sudden just become completely unable to articulate much of anything at all. And why is that? Because we're barking up the wrong tree, my friends. We're listening to the world around us, and we're not thinking in a biblical way about our lives. We are regressing. We find, here's another conversation. These are all conversations I've had over the last week or so. Someone who is really close and who I love very much, and who is 29 and very single. And so she's got herself a boyfriend, and that boyfriend is just like, God who? What? And so, you know, here's a question for us in our singleness is, what do we think about dating and ideas of compatibility and relationship? Is dating.com or whatever, I just kind of made that up, but I'm sure that there are, is that really a thing? Whatever. The point is that we profile who we're looking for. I'm not necessarily saying that that's an appropriate way to find people to connect with, but what I am saying is that what seems to be the main driver in our culture is finding compatibility, finding that person who, you know, completes me or whatever, you know, thing that is. And instead of, what about connecting with people out of a common passion to live life for Jesus Christ? How about that? That's different than what our culture teaches. And so having that idea that we move forward one together spiritually, and that is the root of the thing, is just like the culture's like, what? That's not where it's at. And we find ourselves in tension on that point. On the one side, there's a loneliness thing that says, you know, how long am I going to have to wait? And on the other is the culture saying, you don't have to, your future is a click away. And so there is a tension within the life of faith for single people in this culture. Lastly, on this lines, how do you think about the relationship between generosity and financial security? Our culture says, you know, you really have got to get this sewn up, you know, in your youth, practically. And what that means then is that we don't take risks in giving. We don't put ourselves out in that way. We don't trust, we're never in a position where we ever have to trust God with finances, because we're so focused on our own security, financially based. You know, the whole idea of the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread. You're like, why would I ever pray something like that? Right? Why would I ever pray that? I'm out there making all kinds of bread. And that is a serious spiritual problem. When we can no longer say that we have to trust God in our economic life, because I've got that base covered for myself, thank you. That robs us of an important opportunity to trust God in these key areas of values that are so important to our culture, and so at cross purposes often with our own spiritual well-being. So yeah, there is always going to be danger in regression in the life of faith. And so the question becomes, what safeguards do you have in place in your life? Can we say, like with Jeremiah, that the heart of humanity is deceitful beyond all that we can imagine? Who can understand it, he says. That means your heart and mine. It's easy to look to the value system of the culture and put a Jesus stamp on it and say, there it is. But are we prepared in these very consequential, very important areas of our life to live openly and humbly before people that we trust and say, tell me, am I deceiving myself in this area? Is this something that I've held off for myself because I'm unwilling to entrust it to God? And here I think this question really is the determining question for the quality of our experience in the body of Christ, and just as importantly, our witness to the world. In what way does this body of believers live at cross purposes with a world that is spiraling into the judgment of God? How are we different? That's an important question. So that's an important thing to think about, the life of faith, the danger of regression, and also the danger of cynicism. And what we find is that in these periods of disappointment, and I'll tell you, you know, I can't imagine being Abraham and Sarah, and year after year, and now into the decades, and there is no son, no heir. You know, it is easy to see the hidden rifts in their understanding of God, the suspicions that they harbor about God beginning to really come to the surface. And I remember that both of our children came to us very slowly, which is to say that our first came after about 3 years of practice and 6 or 7 years into our marriage. And I remember my wife, you know, used to do these, you know, take your temperature and you got to put things together at the right moment or whatever. This is really a hard discussion tonight. She takes this thermostat in anger, just whips it across her, and it's one of those old mercury things, shatters all over the house. And I'm like, yeah, this is not going well. But finally our first one came, and then for 6 years we're waiting and waiting, and so it's this kind of infertility medication and that. My wife at one point was going through puberty and menopause every month, and it was just, you know, it was painful for her and for me too. But it really exposed some things in our hearts. This sense of impatience and entitlement, and where is God? And so there's this disappointment thing that is also a part of what we see in Abraham and Sarah. Our disappointed hopes. And we just ask, you know, does God really care sometimes? If we're honest. And it's so interesting. Both Abraham and Sarah, when they laughed, the narrator tells us they laughed how? To themselves. They would never do that out loud, but inwardly, the narrator's exposing their hearts. And inwardly, they're just saying, oh, come on, man. Where is God anyway? He makes all these grandiose promises, but he doesn't deliver. He doesn't care. It's not fair. Or, my favorite, I deserve better. Really? That is an outrageous statement. I deserve what? From God? Yeah, not blessing. Anyway, I think that that's an important piece of this. There are, through the disappointments of life, those things expose these things deeper within our hearts. Suspicions that we have about, is God really good? Is God really powerful? Will God truly honor his promises? And so it's an opportunity for us to really double down on our faith. Here's the point. Your life is a commentary. What does it say about God? If someone's reading their life, what are their inferences about who God is? It's an important question. Do they say God is a menacing moral taskmaster who always makes you feel guilty? Are they reading that God is really impotent and can't really do much of anything other than blah, blah, blah and talk? Are they saying that really being zealous about the things of God ends up being a burnout and resentful? What does the commentary of your life say about God? Is an important question for us to ask, because that tells us where our faith has gone, where it's at. Now, here's the point that Sarah and Abraham are learning on a positive note. It was said some years ago, I think it was Oswald Sanders, this old guy who's just so full of wisdom. He came around and talked a lot about missions, but he made a point. He said, if you're into God, you're into waiting. If you're into God, you're into waiting. Wow. How else could you really learn to trust God if every need that you have is immediately met by God? If God just arranges all circumstances in life so that there's never struggle, what will you do? You will quickly forget that there is such a person as the Almighty God. That's what you will do. And that will lead you to ruin. That will bring you back to Hagar and Sarah. And so God allows time to lapse. God allows us a period of disappointment, of struggle, of wrestling, so that when he does respond to these deep things that he has promised about our lives, it will be evident to us that the answer to this prayer and the fulfillment of his promise has nothing to do with me. And that ends up being a pretty good place when we become convinced that the things that we value the most are things that could never have come from our own hands. That these are things that are the gift of God to us. And that's the way God is going to deal with your life. If you are into really experiencing the blessings of God, the deep things of God in your life, the very things that God wants to give to you, you got to be into waiting. You got to develop that confidence that because God said it, it's going to be. If God promised, he and he alone will deliver. And therefore, that we can take steps of faith and we can act. Here's the bizarre, I think, part of the story for Abraham and Sarah. He's pushing 100. She's pushing 90. God says she's going to have a child. And they didn't, there's something they had to do, right, to make that happen. As impossible as it seemed, they did the one thing that would indicate that they truly believed God and trusted him. And so there it is. And there are things that God is calling on you to do, even here tonight. Things that the blessings of God may seem very distant to you at this point. Okay? And you find yourself struggling in a significant way. But what are those things that he's calling on you to do to trust him in the confidence at the time that is appropriate for you? He will answer and he will affect his purpose and his promise in your life. That is the most important thing. Lastly, this whole thing is really about grace. It's a story about grace. And the point is that grace is a unilateral relationship. When God promises, God alone is the one who delivers. What has God promised? God has promised of Abraham that he'll make of him a great nation. What has he promised? He's promised David, I'll make an eternal kingdom for you. What has he promised? He promised there's a day coming when I will pour out my spirit on all humanity and they will know me as a father to a son. What do we know for sure? What has God promised? God has promised that he loved the world so much that he was prepared to come, and he did, and he died for the sins of humanity. He died for yours because he promises that if you will receive the forgiveness that uniquely comes through Jesus Christ on the basis of his death on your behalf, that you will become a child of God. That's a unilateral promise. What do you bring to the table? Nothing. Nothing. There's no merit. All you do is receive the gift that he offers. That's how it works. That's how it works with all of God's promises. He promises, he delivers, and it's a picture of grace that what we do is we receive. We can reject. We have that freedom. But if we want the promises of God, we just simply receive what he brings to us. I think it's an important part of our thinking here to realize that this is not the end of the story. Those barrels that are around your life that everyone sees with such clarity and finds as annoying as all of us who drive through Westerville, that's not the end of the story. Because God is a God of promise, and he has said in Philippians 1 verse 6, I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ. That he is at work in our lives, that at the end of history we have the promise of being conformed utterly to the image of Christ. A time is coming, my friends, when all of the things that we struggle with, all the broken parts of who we are fading away. And we become that person that God intended us to be in Christ. And that's why at the end of history, the tears of suffering are wiped away in the presence of God who has made us new and made us complete. How will that happen? He will make that happen. We do not make that happen. God does. So the last thing that we want to say then is this question: how can we wait well? And I don't have the answer for you. That's the answer that we need to talk about here.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.